Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's a Larry Mueller Show Book Club Day. Always fun to do that. And as I always do at the start of the show, it's a chance to remind you how we make our selections for our, we do six selections a year. Every other month we have one. And we zero in on the author has to be from Wisconsin, or the author has to have written the setting about Wisconsin, or a Wisconsin author who's writing about Wisconsin. And today we've got both. We got Jeff Elzinga with us. He's an emeritus professor of writing at Lakeland University. He was former American diplomat to Africa. And he has a novel titled Pigeon Falls, and it's kind of about, I'll have him talk about it, but it's kind of a specialized team of construction workers who are working to bring wind farms into being in Wisconsin. I'll let him go into more detail on that. And I found it really a fascinating read for a variety of reasons, which we will get into as we move along here, but it's set in Pigeon Falls, Wisconsin, and I hope you'll join in with your thoughts. It's Pigeon Falls, a small community. What do you think about small community life? He does a nice job of talking about that in the book. What do you think about family farms maybe becoming sources of renewable energy? There's a lot in the news even today about that, I believe, in Marathon County, where there's a wind farm being proposed, and some resistance to it among the folks who live in that area. At any rate, I hope you'll join in, and hopefully you've read the book. If you haven't, that's fine. You can call and ask questions anyway. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jeff Elzinga, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, Larry. I'm very happy to be here with you.
Here you've got a construction crew building concrete bases for enormous wind turbines. How did you hit on this for the basis of a novel?
Well, when I first came up with the idea for the book, it was many years ago. I was living in Madison with a couple of friends. It was October. We were kind of out of money. And we heard about a construction job in Iowa. And at that time, we got the job. We went out there and we built concrete hog confinements.
Oh!
Now, this is the middle of the 1970s. I gave up on the idea then and brought it back about 40 years later. Hog confinements were not a big deal at that time. And I thought, how can I get a construction crew that works with concrete and rebar? And I came upon the idea of the guys who make the platforms for wind turbines. And they use concrete and rebar. And that worked its way into the story.
Well, it's a kind of a fascinating story. And Pigeon Falls, there are a lot of themes. There's that construction theme. That's kind of one of the themes which I found fascinating. And there are other themes. What do you want to say about these people by telling this story, the small town life?
Well, I think the theme about construction is there is the idea of teamwork in the story, and that balance between, you know, what are the desires of an individual and the needs of a team or a family or a community, and how do you balance those two different things? So that's one of the themes. I think there's also a theme about that talks about greed, and to what point do we compromise our values and our self-respect to earn money, even with a construction crew. I think there's probably also another theme about heroism. You know, when we are given an opportunity to help someone, do we step back or do we step forward? And it's not always an easy choice of what you do. So those are some of the themes. Setting it in a small town like Pigeon Falls, I got to work with the community more, some of the characters who who live in the town and the issues, the situations that they're dealing with every day.
And you do a nice job of capturing, I think, the essence of the folks who live there.
Oh, thank you.
It was really cool. Well, let's talk about the wind turbines for a bit. I thought the detail in this, it was so fascinating to me, the work that goes into this, these wind turbines.
It surprised me, too, when I started to investigate. And I would go out and look at wind turbines, and not only for the kind of the aesthetic of how they move, because I was fascinated by that, but also what is involved in building one. So I looked at a lot of videos online, read a lot of reports on how they're built, and kind of wove that into the story.
And when I was reading it, I thought, I wonder if he worked on one of these. Because you seem to know so much about just the base of the turbine to put it in.
It was just a lot of study.
And the exactness that it has to be, and the amount of, I mean, how much concrete? I forgot how much concrete goes into one of those bases.
I don't remember myself, but it was a lot. And part of it was because the narrator is the surveyor.
Yeah.
So he's very much interested in numbers and precision. So if he's telling the story, he's going to tell us how wide the base is and how high it is and, you know, how far apart you put everything, because he's measuring all that.
Tom Bishop is the, if I'm not mistaken, was the narrator in the story. Well, why don't you explain kind of the story itself? Give us the rough outline of what's all going on, because, I mean, winter's coming. There's a bunch of things going on.
Okay. It's a construction crew that travels around the upper Midwest, and they build the platforms for wind turbines, the part that goes underground and anchors the turbine tower to the ground. And they mostly work from April till October. They have now finished their normal work season because it's now the end of October, but the weather has been exceptionally warm. There's been a second summer, or some people say an Indian summer, that is permitting them to do one more job. So they've been called to take on this responsibility of putting another platform in, and they want to do it before the weather turns cold. So there's kind of a rush to get this done, because once it gets too cold, you can't put concrete and rebar together without putting a chemical in there, which then eats away the rebar. So that's kind of why we don't see a lot of road construction in the wintertime.
Well, where it's being installed is outside of town on a hog farm.
Yeah, it's an old hog farm that the family of this farmer had, and he's trying to do something to find success in his family. His family and generations before him have tried to grab that American dream and been unsuccessful, and he's kind of desperate now. He got a grant from the government to build this wind farm on his property. There's an exceptional current of wind that goes through because of the contours of the land, and he wants to get it done, and he'll stop at nothing to do that.
And he's not the nicest guy you ever met either.
He's not. No.
and he has he's got the money. The money came from?
The money came from the federal government because of a different program that he got involved in.
Yeah. So he had the money. You know, and throughout the book, the benefits of clean wind energy is talked about, but concerns about some environmental damage come to play. And government funding of wind farms also, as you say, was mentioned. How do you feel about wind energy?
I think the future is, I mean, the farmer does say this too, that the future is renewable energy. It has to be. And whether it's wind or solar or wave energy, whatever, I think that's the way we're going to eventually have to go.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. And most of the crew has worked together on these sites for a long time. And the crew follows, I think it's two rules?
That's right. One is to lend a hand whenever anyone needs help, and the other is can't talk on the job about politics or religion.
I think that's a really good, those are two really good rules. Always lend a hand and don't talk about politics or religion with the people that you work with.
And it seems to work for them.
Yeah. Jeff Elzinga, our guest today, and we'll take your calls. If you want to have a question or comment, maybe you've read the book and want to comment on it, the number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email. The email address is talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our book club selection for this month is titled Pigeon Falls. Jeff Elzinga is the author of the book. And again, if you want to join in with your questions or comments, I hope you will. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Chris in Cooksville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi there, Larry and guest. What a wonderful program. What a wonderful interviewer you've been over these decades. Thank you for what you've done. My gosh.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chris.
You'll be missed. I'm very environmentally minded, and I need to be told how efficient wind generators are. And I know that concrete is one of the biggest polluters, and here we're building platforms of concrete, enormous amounts of concrete to support a tower. Then the disposal of the blades after they're used, they're just burying them in Wyoming. These things really bother me. I need to be told that they're efficient and more useful and smarter than coal.
All right. So Chris wants to know a little bit more about the wind energy and its efficiencies and what goes into it.
Well, I wish I could speak more specifically. Maybe some of the power companies would know more of those details. And I think with any kind of energy, there are the trade-offs and even nuclear energy, you know, mm-hmm. which can produce a lot of power. You have disposal things you have to worry about there too. And wind energy and solar, they have materials. Some of those are not easily repurposed, and you have to deal with those, and it is a trade-off.
Well, and one of these turbines is going to last, what is it, 20 years?
Yeah, 20 to 25 years.
20 to 25 years. And I think you have Tom Bishop and the crew surveyor saying that the platforms are, I think he says, 290 feet tall, and they weigh about 180 tons. So you've got that, but you're talking about that over 25 years, and then if you think of the amount of pollution that comes from, let's say, coal or other gas and other things of that nature, if you look at what if you had to spend that same amount on of money that you spend and environmental money, let's call it that you spend on wind versus coal or gas, I think over the 20, 25 years, you're going to find out that the wind is going to come out ahead.
I think that's really a good point. There is an enormous upfront cost, but unlike coal, which you're putting coal into the power plants every week or every month, in wind, the wind just keeps going, and you're not replacing the cement in the platform. You're not replacing the rebar all the time. You're not even replacing the tower and the blades that much. So they last a long time.
Yeah. And I think those bases are going to last even beyond if you put another, you could put another wind generator on top of that base.
Yes.
So that base is in there for probably longer than 25 years.
And the narrator in the story does talk about that his legacy, because he's divorced, he has no children, he's wondering what his legacy is, and he thinks it is the platforms that he's building, because after he's gone, they will continue to service a lot of other people that'll benefit.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. The company is called, you call it Midwest Stable Platforms, is the name of the company. And you say it's a business that takes care of its people. What do you mean by that?
Well, my experience seeing a lot of different businesses is, and reading about things, of course, in the newspaper and on the news, that profit is really the thing that drives most businesses. And there's almost never enough profit. And the people who end up taking kind of the short part of that are the workers. And, arguing over benefits, arguing over salary, arguing over working conditions. Well, Midwest Stable Platforms takes a different approach. They certainly want profits. I mean, they're in business to, be in business.
Make money.
Right. But they take care of their workers. They look after them. They support them. They go to bat for them. And that's why the narrator likes the company so much. And they're successful because of it.
Yeah, and the guys that work together are working together in really as a unit, and everybody's helping everybody, but they all have their specific tasks. But you lend a hand where somebody else needs to help immediately. And you write about, one of the things that really caught my eye was you write about the music of work. And I was going to ask you, because I thought you did a nice job with that, if you could talk about the music of work.
Well, I got the idea for that, and it wasn't at the beginning, of course, of writing the book, but it came along. One of my sons works in the construction trades, and mostly building houses or renovating houses. And I've watched him work at times, and there's always music playing on the job site. And it seems like the guys that he works with like that, and that's where I got the idea from.
And in this case, the music had to go away.
In this case, the music had to go away. We see this progression when talking about the theme of greed throughout the story. Is the construction crew, so they work longer hours, cut back on their meal breaks, their coffee breaks, things like that, to take more money because this farmer, the client, is so set on getting this tower up in time before the winter comes. Well, one of the things that they also give up on is their music.
Yeah. Wait, could you give us a reading from the book?
Sure.
Yeah.
This would be then a short piece where the farmer has just paid the crew $500 each cash, no taxes, to give up the playing of their music at work. So there's no more radio, no more boombox. This is fairly early in the story. All afternoon we make good progress. Joyce's delicious meal and our not having to drive to town for lunch have opened unexpected reserves of energy in all of us. And just as Burnell wanted, not listening to music has also helped us focus solely on the job in front of us. Though by mid-afternoon, I've also noticed that we've stopped talking to one another. You might think we'd talk more without music, that we'd fill in the silence with conversation, but we don't. The rest of the afternoon continues to roll out in this muted way, and after a while, I feel like I'm laboring alone. A solitary and soundless emptiness has taken hold of me. With friends working right beside me, it's illogical to feel as isolated as I'm feeling now. So I say nothing about it to anyone. Then, out of the quiet, I notice the high-pitched pinging sound of a hammer pounding a nail. Then the whoosh of a shovel cutting dirt. Determined footsteps are shuffling their comings and goings. A toolbox opens and closes. Up on the nest, someone sighs, and I know whose breath it is. Behind me, there's the creak of a wooden pallet, followed by the clang from steel batting steel. When Eddie groans, I finally understand what I'm listening to, the music of work. All around me are the daily melodies a construction crew makes when building something important. I've heard these tunes 1,000 times before, but until this afternoon, I never stopped to listen. This afternoon's absence of conversation and the jailing of Buck's boombox had me feeling uneasy. It had my mind wandering in places I'd rather not go. Now, each whirl of a drill is brightening my mood. Each turn of Bud's crane is lifting my spirits. Up on Burnell's Plateau, we're making our own playlist, a construction crew's playlist. And if I had the right words, I could sing along.
That's a wonderful piece. And thank you so much for reading it. So the music of work. There you have it. We'll take some more calls. I have plenty more questions, but let's take a call from Jack in Madison. Jack, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I just wanted to mention that I feel like you guys, a point that was missed earlier versus the regarding the cost of, say, coal or natural gas plants versus wind or solar, is that there's a lot of resources consumed in the building of a coal or natural gas plant and its eventual decommissioning. And I think if you look at the numbers on that, the amount of resources probably equal or exceed those of a wind farm or a solar farm. So that was just, I feel like that point got missed and wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, Jack, thanks for bringing that up. I think he's right about that, Jeff.
I agree. And, yeah, I'm not advocating in the book for one or the other. In fact,
no.
there's a part in the book where the construction company, of course, is very positive about wind energy. They believe in it completely. And then there's this young guy who's part of the crew, and he brings up all of these negatives about it, which the rest of the crew is not ready for. But, I'd agree with the caller that renewable is the way for the future.
Jack, thank you very much. Meg emailed to say she loved your book, especially the relationship among the workers and then the relationship between the workers and the community. Can you talk about your approach to building character and relationships in fiction?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one that I ask myself all the time, too, because creating real, believable characters does take a lot of thought and work. I think I build character the same way I build a story. I start with sort of the basics, try to figure out who's doing what, and then it's almost like oil painting, where you put a layer of color on, you put a detail on, and then you add more to it, and you add more to it, and you add more to it. And you refine, you revise, you change things. And at the end, you have a lot more depth. So when I created the different characters, those on the crew and those in town, I tried to give each one something that would make him or her stand out more. And that's what I tried to do.
David in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to indicate I've read the book, Pigeon Falls, and I found it excellent, and the story character development was done very well. My question, though, to the author, does he have any other books in the hopper that he might be working on?
Yeah, maybe talk about your first book, and because what you're working on now relates to the very first one you wrote.
The first one I wrote that was published in 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic, takes place in Africa, and it's a story about an American diplomat and his relationship with a visiting American journalist. The journalist goes missing into the bush during a civil war, the beginning of a civil war in a country, and the diplomat has to go looking for him. The problem in the story is that the diplomat and the journalist don't see eye to eye. the end of the story, something happens to the diplomat, and the book I'm working on now is where is that diplomat 10 years later? So that's what I'm working on.
And the reason for that is a lot of people asked.
A lot of people asked, what happens to the so-and-so?
Yeah, and that the first book, The Distance Between Stars, was the title of that, and that was a finalist for the Midwest Book Award.
Yes, yeah, it was.
As well. So there's one already done, and there's another one in the hopper, David, I guess. And glad to know that you enjoyed the book. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And you can join in, too. Hope you do. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. And that relationship between the people in the community and the workers was really well done. And they're in town a lot. I mean, explain what that part of it.
Well, since they're a traveling crew, they have to stay somewhere, and they find this place that has rooms to let, and they also have a bar, and they also have a restaurant. So they eat their meals. Well, they start eating all their meals there. They eat all of their dinners there, and they stay in the rooms. So in the course of being in Pigeon Falls, they get to know the bartender, they get to know the waitresses, they get to know some of the townspeople who come into the barn.
And there's some really good discussions. I mean, you have a kind of a nice one between the gal who runs the post office, as an example, and I think it's Tom that comes in and to send something out in the mail and gets into a discussion about Pigeon Falls itself and how it got its name.
Yeah, and in fact, there are these photographs on the wall of the Horseshoe Inn where they're staying, and he's looking at them one day, and a lady comes up behind him, and she's sort of like the town historian, I think. She knows.
Yeah.
She's been there seven or four generations herself. I think she says her grandchildren are the seventh generation or something like that, and he's looking at all these old black-and-white photographs, and she takes him through who different people are and what the town was like 100 years ago, and then eventually gets to a discussion about how the town got its name.
And the town...
Which is a true story.
And that was probably during the time of, if I'm not mistaken, during the passenger pigeon time. I looked up and did a little research on myself on it, and apparently there was a roosting areas up there for millions of passenger pigeons, and they literally would break the branches. And she did it. And that conversation was just a really cool conversation. I'm probably mixing it up with another conversation he had at the post office, or maybe the gal was a postal worker, and I've forgotten that. It's been a few weeks since I finished the book, so I really remember, but I really enjoyed that conversation between the two of them. You capture those conversations really well, I think.
Well, thank you. She was an interesting character, too, that she has all of these sayings and proverbs and whatever that she brings up at different times throughout the story.
One of the things you talk about that you probably must have lived, that you talk about the pressure of wind on your body as you work.
I've noticed it myself, and that's why I did put it in the book, knowing that there was wind in this area, a lot of wind. And I then did some research on it and talk a little bit about how sailors in the old days on sailing ships, the wind would be so fierce that it could drive someone crazy.
Yeah, and of course you're working on a wind farm.
Right.
You're building a wind farm, and you're in an area, it was a pretty cool area, where the wind is constantly really blowing all the time.
Right, it's not a normal wind, it's really a super wind.
How much, let's talk about that area. It's, you know, a small town. Pigeon Falls actually exists, small town in western Wisconsin. And I'm wondering how much of your description of the community match the real town of Pigeon Falls. It's just south of Eau Claire.
I think about 30 miles south of Eau Claire. I visited it a number of times to get a feel for the town as well as the lay of the land and the driftless area. I tried to be true to the feeling that I got there. I mean, this is a wonderful, quiet community, people caring about each other. They have a real nice life there. It's very small. I've eaten in places in town, but the Horseshoe Inn, where it's kind of the center of the story, is made up. I didn't use a real place there.
Well, I you had me wanting to go for that special on Saturday night, was it?
The spaghetti and ribs.
Spaghetti and ribs. I thought, apparently people came from 50 miles away to come and have the spaghetti and ribs on a Saturday night. What are the, have you gotten reaction from people who live in Pigeon Falls about the book?
Maybe about an hour from now I might.
Oh, are you on your way there?
No, but if I get any emails or something.
Well, maybe somebody from Pigeon Falls is listening in and can give a call. It'd be fun to know what folks. You should do a reading there, for goodness sakes.
That would be great. It was a wonderful little town, very nice town.
One of the areas that we haven't really touched on, part of the book, is, in my mind, domestic abuse comes into play in your novel.
Yeah, it's a crucial storyline through the novel, and what happens and how the crew reacts, and at the end of the story everything is kind of tied together. But it wasn't originally in the plan when I first laid out the novel. But again, as things develop and I'm changing things here and there, and this sounds like something I want to talk about.
Yeah, and it has to do with one of the waitresses. And this is how you get, I'm thinking about this because I've thought all the way back to my PhD research, where I was doing PhD. My research was in some relatively small communities, Neillsville, Cumberland, Barron, relatively small communities, but I would be there for a week at a time to do the work. And so I got a chance. You do get a chance to meet people. You meet people at the restaurant. You meet people at the hotel. You meet, and you have a chance to interact. And I felt like you were capturing kinds of things that I felt about when I have been in those kind of situations myself. Well, I wasn't building a wind turbine, but I was building a research project is what I was doing with another guy, Glenn Broom. And I found those interactions really great.
Well, I think one of the things that helps is the character who is the waitress, that she's very outgoing, and she's very friendly to everyone, and she immediately strikes up a good conversation with all of the crew members, and they kind of take a liking to her. She's very young. She's just almost a year out of high school, and when they notice some of the bruising on her wrists and whatever, they take even more interest in her because they like her so much already, that develops one thing into another. The narrator gets involved. Other crew members get involved, and things kind of escalate from there with her husband.
Absolutely. Got an email from Lee who says that he loved the book, especially the character Burnell, and he was so well-written, Lee could hear his voice and see his expressions. Was he based on an experience of the authors or someone or a compilation of people he's known? Could you speak to the development of this character, Burnell? And you should tell us about the character Burnell and what he was like.
Well, Burnell is desperate to be successful. In fact, he's desperate to be rich. He sees the American dream as something that he's been unable to hold on to. And he wants to have a lot of money. He wants to be successful. That's how he interprets success. But he's also got an edge to him, and he's kind of a mean guy, and he's demanding, and he thinks because, you know, he has this loan from the federal government to build this big project, and he's kind of a know-it-all. He likes giving orders, and I mean, maybe that's just in his family's DNA, but he's real good at it, and that's part of the friction that is between him and then the construction crew. Did I know anybody like that? When I started writing the book, I never thought of the book in any political way. That was not an intention. But readers, early drafts, pointed out that some of the mannerisms of Burnell Sandberg mimicked people that they knew in the news. And I started to realize that, yeah, I guess subconsciously, maybe I was. He's unkind. He's selfish. He's demanding. He's unreasonable. And, yeah, I guess maybe that's true.
Our guest today, Jeff Elzinga, his novel Pigeon Falls. Join in with your questions or comments as we move along. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you listening in today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jeff Elzinga. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about liability insurance with my good friend, attorney Michael Riley. So looking forward to that. And tomorrow on the show, Melinda Myers joins us to talk about landscaping with pollinators in mind. And then we'll talk to organic gardener Tova Martin about the indoors and outdoors of houseplants and making that transition work. That's tomorrow on Garden Talk. But right now we're looking at Jeff Elzinga's novel, Pigeon Falls, a great, really fun novel to read, and it's our book club selection for this month. Questions or comments, if you've read the book or just have a question, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Just go back to that domestic abuse for a bit. Candace is reluctant to get the police involved. Why?
I think part of it is there's a part that she denies that it's really as bad as it is. She wants to believe that the person she's just married a few months earlier isn't going to be like that. He always, you know, apologizes, sends her flowers, does things like that, that, oh, I didn't really mean it. And she's sort of early into the cycle.
Yeah.
I think she's a very smart person. She spent a year at university. He kind of forced her out, started to gain control of her life, got her to be a waitress. He's always monitoring her activities, the husband. She's starting to realize that something's really not right. She gives excuses for his behavior. You know, he was kind of bullied by his father. He doesn't like rules. And she uses those as excuses. But the crew now have started to tell her, wait a minute, this is not right, Candace. You got to do something about this.
And she talks to Tom in the book, the narrator, about the philosophical concept of loving one's fate.
Right. And there There's this idea, it's called amor fati, and loving one's fate, a concept that came out 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a spokesman for the concept or an expert in Nietzsche, but I think what he would say is that this idea is you make the best of whatever life throws at you, and that whether it's good or bad, you learn from it. And I don't think Nietzsche meant it in any way that this was an excuse for pain and suffering or things like that, or to give up on life as if there's nothing you can do about what happens to you. It's not fatalism, maybe the opposite of that. It's that, you know, when bad things do happen, when there is misfortune, take advantage of the things you can control, and move your life forward that way, which is what Candace is trying to do.
Yeah, that's well put. And Tom, the narrator, there's also a health aspect to this as well, in the sense that Tom is suffering from stomach pain, digestive issues, and so that plays a role, and because it's kind of in the back of his mind as things go along in the book.
It is, and again, another part of the storyline. I think if I hadn't had that as part of it, that Tom having these medical questions, I might have written the book in third person, but it's written in first person because I wanted the reader to be closer to him and get his thoughts a little more directly. The book starts where he's going to a clinic for some tests, and the story kind of ends with him going back to the clinic to get the results. And along the way, we know that his diet has changed and he's feeling some discomfort and whatever.
Yeah, it's always in the back of his mind, and it's always in the back of your, obviously, then, and myself as a reader, or any other reader probably, is what's going to happen to Tom down the road. One of the things I enjoyed were his musings as he drove through the community, and that's a, I think, well, talk about how you put that together, because you must have experienced some of that.
At the beginning, you mean when he's going from the clinic to Pigeon Falls? Or
And when he is, yeah, and then driving around Pigeon Falls, too, it comes into play.
Well, I wanted to, you know, I think the setting, of course, is really important, and I wanted to set the stage for how the village was constructed, how the landscape around the village was. People get a feeling for the little creeks and rivers that are there, the bluffs, the escarpment that goes up, and the wind towers on the top, the types of trees that are around, their colors now. The story takes place, begins on Halloween.
It's
the end of October. As he's driving through some of the surrounding villages on his way to the job site, to Pigeon Falls, he goes through a town that has trick-or-treaters out, and the police are stopping the traffic, and the little kids are going across the street. And he looks around, and he sees, again, another kind of quiet town, and the people doing their normal daily activities.
And that comes into play, I think, too, in the, I mean, there's a fire, which gives you a chance to talk about community working together as well.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I guess in this short time period, because the book takes place over only about a week and a half.
Yeah,
there are a number of incidents that happen, and I wanted to keep the story moving along, and hopefully that's what happened.
Yeah, and there are some others. We're not going to have time to go into it all. John wants to know about your approach to writing. How do you develop? In other words, how do you come up with a novel, and how do you work on the novel?
Well, when I was growing up, I think I was always interested in stories. There were stories on television. There were a lot of Westerns and detective stories when I was growing up, 30 minutes on television. And they always had a beginning, middle, and end. Then I would read stories by Ernest Hemingway, John Steinbeck, J.D. Salinger, James Joyce. And they always had a beginning, middle, and end. And at the end, you felt that it was complete, that you learned something and something happened and was resolved or wasn't resolved. So I wanted to create something like that. I'm not a genre writer. I can't write science fiction or fantasy. It's just not in my ability to do that. So I like to just tell a story about real people and some of the situations they come up with. So when I had the first novel, I had a situation that I wanted to investigate. With this one, I wanted to write about a crew, and I wanted to write about a farmer and how they don't see eye to eye. And so I got where it was going to take place. I kind of got the beginning of the story, the end of the story, and then I tried to fill in between. And again, this layering effect. So many details happen in the 9th, 10th, 11th draft that I never even thought about originally. And then I can readjust the story to make some of those work, and hopefully it adds, you know, depth to the story.
And how much time do you spend, I mean, in the course of a week? Is it one of those where you're writing certain number, amount of time every day, or how do you approach that, I think, is part of his question, too.
Well, when I'm able to, which when I'm really involved, like I am in the story that I'm writing now, I try to do 3 to 4 hours a day. 4 hours is good. To go beyond that, my brain kind of is squeezed out pretty much. But if I can get up a momentum of 2 or 3 weeks of 3 or 4 hours a day, then I'm going full steam, and then it's productive.
Yeah, that's a lot of other writers I've talked to say that they spend like a similar amount of time, and your mind starts to wander a bit after 3-4 hours, and you're not as productive as you were when you began. Or maybe there's a little tough beginning, but then you get rolling, and then you're rolling for quite a while, and then your mind starts to wander, and then you say, wait a minute, I better go get lunch. Are you a morning guy?
It's morning. But the funny thing is, so many good ideas come right before I fall asleep at night. So I keep a legal pad next to the bed. Sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night, have an idea. If I don't write those down, the next day I won't remember them. But sometimes it'll be a sentence, it'll be a word, it'll be a situation, and I make a note of it, and they don't always work, but sometimes they do.
Well, it's they work pretty well this time around, Jeff. And it's been a lot of fun talking with you. The book, hopefully you will sell some more copies of it today as a result of being on the show. But it's been a pleasure to talk with you about it. I enjoyed it, and I'm pretty sure our listeners, well, the listeners we've heard from all enjoyed it very much. So, Jeff, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. It's an honor.
It's my last interview with a book club author. So you're the last one, Jeff. Lee Rayburn will be doing it a couple months from now with our next offer. But in the meantime, thank you so much for writing Pigeon Falls and for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jeff Elzinga is the author of his first book, The Distance Between Stars, but this book is titled Pigeon Falls. It's a novel. I think you'll enjoy reading it if you haven't done so already. Coming up, we're going to take a look at some legal things. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.